Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thank you for joining me again. Last Independence Day, last 4th of July, the social justice conscious ice cream company Ben & Jerry's posted a message to Twitter celebrating the nation's founding by calling on the United States government to return the quote-unquote stolen indigenous land on which the nation was formed. Ben & Jerry's tweeted, quote, "This 4th of July, it's high time we recognize that the U.S. exists on stolen indigenous land and commit to returning it," unquote. The company then went on to propose that the United States begin with Mount Rushmore. And it goes on to read, quote, "What is the meaning of Independence Day for those whose land this country stole? Those who were murdered and forced with brutal violence onto reservations? Those who were pushed from their holy places and denied their freedom? The faces on Mount Rushmore are the faces of men who actively worked to destroy indigenous cultures and ways of life, to deny indigenous people their basic rights," unquote. Well, Ben & Jerry's did not lead the way by committing to return the land on which their headquarters was built to the indigenous people who once owned it, so we can pretty much dismiss their statement as just empty virtue signaling. But it reflects a widespread corrosive misconception in America and the rest of the West that the history of European colonialism throughout the New World is nothing but one long atrocity-studded narrative of genocide, exploitation, theft, and oppression. In fact, it's fashionable now for self-loathing Western multiculturalists to begin many public events, from lectures to performing arts productions to city council meetings, with statements acknowledging that the venues in which those events take place sit on lands stolen from the natives. Western governments now feel obliged to offer up very solemn mea culpas for abominations of centuries past, like slavery. Statues erected to honor Western explorers, leaders, soldiers, and even abolitionists like Frederick Douglass have been targeted in recent years for removal and or destruction because their association with colonialism causes harm and makes young people of non-European origin feel unsafe. Similarly, schools, streets, and buildings named after revered figures in Western history are being renamed to erase their tarnished legacy and to pacify the feelings of sensitive snowflakes. Thanksgiving Day dinners now are routinely ruined by self-righteous media talking heads, anti-intellectual intellectuals, and brainwashed college students denouncing the holiday for its whitewashing of the supposed colonialist genocide of Native Americans. For decades now, activist educators have indoctrinated young people to be ashamed of and outraged by their own cultural heritage. No matter that Western civilization has provided more prosperity, liberty, and opportunities for untold numbers of people worldwide than any other culture in history, those benefits are now viewed to have been achieved on the backs of exploited, brutalized Native peoples. Our culture is in desperate need of a comprehensive antidote to all of this poisonous historical revisionism. We need to have a balanced, national conversation that gets past unhinged anti-Western ideology to look at the history of the New World in a factual context and with a clear-eyed perspective about Western colonialism, both good and bad. I bring up all of this about left-wing hostility to Western colonialism because my guest today at The Right Take has written a book refuting anti-colonialist falsehoods and presenting the balanced truth about European colonialism in the New World. So please stay with us as we pause for a little musical break coming up, because you do not want to miss this discussion. In fact, don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the conversations we're having here. Remember, if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It really helps. We will be right back with my guest. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is Dr. Jeff Finn Paul. That's F-Y-N-N hyphen P-A-U-L. Dr. Jeff Finn Paul, he's a professor of economics and global history at Leiden University, the oldest university in the Netherlands and one of the top research institutions in Europe. The author of dozens of scholarly articles and books, Professor Finn Paul conducts historical research in eight languages. That's eight languages. And is a winner of the 2016 European History Quarterly Prize. In addition to being an editor for the Journal of Global Slavery, he's also the presenter of a short PragerU video titled, Are We Living on Stolen Land?, which you should check out. It gives you a preview of what you can expect from his latest book, which I happen to have read and reviewed for frontpagemag.com. I gave it two big thumbs up, and we're going to talk about that today because it covers a vital topic that people get heated about. And he's going to drop some truth bombs about it. Dr. Finn Paul, welcome to the Right Take podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, Mark.
Could we start with a little bit of your background? Where are you from and how did you end up at Leiden University?
Yeah, sure. No problem. Well, I was born in Florida, but we moved up to Pennsylvania when I was a little kid. And so I was raised outside of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania in the Moravian settlement there. And so there was a lot of history in my area. And also I was friends with some people who were descended from Native Americans growing up because there were a number of Native Americans who had gone to live with the Moravians. So I was already inundated in Native American history and settler history from an early age. Then I went to the UK for undergraduate just to go see some European history and learn it firsthand. I eventually went to the University of Toronto for a PhD because they gave me the most money. But eventually I had to get a job. I taught in the States for a little while right after my PhD. But I eventually had to move to Europe partially because the American historical establishment was already closing down in terms of free speech. I could already feel which way the wind was blowing. This was 15 years ago. So the Netherlands took me in.
And also, before I forget, I'm a little curious about the Journal of Global Slavery, too. What is that all about?
Yeah, well, the great thing about the Netherlands is they really have had a global outlook ever since the pilgrims, the Pilgrim Fathers first actually left from the Netherlands to go to Plymouth. So they've been taking people in from all over the world for a long time. So there's a lot of global history that happens in the Netherlands. And we started this this Journal of Global Slavery, some of my colleagues and I, to tell the story about slavery around the world, not just from an American and Atlantic point of view.
And so it's historical. It's oriented toward history rather than present day slavery, because I think a lot of people may not know that slavery in some ways is a more widespread problem today than ever before in history. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, in some ways, yes. But I mean, you know, officially, slavery has been outlawed, so now you have to come up with other definitions of slavery. In the past, it was much more open.
Well, I'm eager to get to your new book because I think it's so important, and I want to give people a taste of all the misconceptions and even lies that you address in it. It's called Not Stolen, The Truth About European Colonialism in the New World. And I think anyone who's paid attention to what's going on in the culture in recent years would recognize from the title alone that this is a pretty triggering topic for some people. In fact, I think it's pretty bold of you to have published such a book, considering that as an academic, you're kind of immersed in a setting that is very often hostile to anything less than a full-throated condemnation of Western civilization. What kind of feedback or even blowback maybe have you received from colleagues and students about this book, having written it, a book that some people who haven't actually read it will perceive to be just a whitewashing of European exploitation and genocide?
Yeah, well, I mean, a few years ago, I wrote what became the kernel of this book in an article in The Spectator, and it went viral around the world because there's a lot of people who really want to hear a balanced history of North American colonization. But of course, almost immediately, when you anger 10,000, shall we call them woke historians, you're going to get a lot of blowback. So I had people caricaturing my argument, assuming that I was saying Europeans did no evil, when I very specifically said, what we really need is a balanced account. Yes, Europeans did some evil, but they were not 100% evil. That is more than enough to trigger most of my colleagues. And to me, that says they don't have a scientific mindset. They don't want to know what actually happened in history. They only want a propagandistic version. And how can they call themselves historians or scientists if that's the take they're taking? So I felt I had to write this book just to get the full picture out there. And that's really what I aim for.
Is it your sense that your colleagues in the Netherlands are maybe more woke than here in the United States, or the other way around? Are they a little, were they a little more open-minded in Europe or worse?
Well, I think that in general, every European country is insulated by their own language from some of the crazier things that are going on in the English-speaking world. So I think European countries are a little more skeptical about wokeness, which really the epicenter of it was in the United States. So, yeah, it's a little less crazy over here, if you want. And then, of course, I think in Canada, things have gone even more off the deep end.
And what about your students? Are young people in your experience, in your classes, do they seem to be a little less attracted to some of the woke insanity that we see going on, or are they completely brainwashed by the time they get to your classes?
Well, I'm happy to report that there's a wide spectrum of beliefs. I mean, there's a small minority of students who come in. I have students from 50 countries around the world. They're not all native English speakers. So they realize that the American example on which wokeness is based, the idea that slavery was the center of the universe only in the United States, a lot of students come in taking all that with a grain of salt already, which helps temper their views. So there's only a small minority of people who are, you know, truly outrageously woke, if you want to put it that way. And so it's nice to see that spectrum.
Good. I don't want you to have to give away any spoilers about your book, but I'd like to dig into a few of your chapter topics, all of which you have framed as questions like, did Europeans commit genocide in the New World? Did the founders steal democracy from Native Americans? Did Europeans starve, massacre, or spread disease among the natives? Let's talk about one of the real flashpoints in discussions of European colonialism, and that's Christopher Columbus. You have a chapter titled Intrepid Explorer or Genocidal Maniac, The Complex Case of Christopher Columbus. From your research, which was he? Was he in fact a little bit of both? What's the truth about Christopher Columbus?
Well, that's just it. I mean, what you hear now, if you Google Christopher Columbus, I think something like the top 20 Google returns you're going to get say something about genocide, massacre, slavery, you know, all sorts of like basically the worst crimes against humanity that anyone could ever commit. But in reality, Columbus was just a guy. He was a man. He was an administrator. He was dealing with real life on the ground warfare situations. They were relatively small scale wars with just a couple hundred people on either side. But in such cases, there are going to be some atrocities, and there are going to be at some point some people were taken as slaves. But only a few hundred, and they were quickly released by the Spanish crown. So there were a lot of messy things going on, but was Columbus any more evil than any other military governor in any other province in the world? No. And that's the thing. So, for example, people are claiming that there were millions upon millions of natives who lived on Hispaniola, the island where Columbus first set up shop, and that today has Haiti and the Dominican Republic. It's an island in the Caribbean. And so people were saying there were maybe up to 8 million natives living there in 1491. And we have a census that says by 1530, there was only about 30,000 people there. Well, then everyone jumps to the conclusion that these 8 million people were massacred by Columbus and his successors. But in reality, there was nowhere near 8 million people living there, partially because they were using Stone Age tools and they didn't have draft animals, so they could hardly grow anything like that much food. And in fact, recent genetic studies have shown there was maybe only about 40,000 people there in 1491. So in other words, most of the island's population survived. But it's outrageous, the claims that you see on the internet, millions killed. You know, so this whole idea of genocide is basically made up out of broadcloth.
And what about this very loaded term, genocide, at least in the context of European colonialism? I think there's a very common assumption that these European settlers were hell-bent on the genocide of Native Americans. What's the reality of that?
Yeah, well, that's just it. When you know deeper history like I do, I can go back further in time than most of my colleagues. I know that Europeans had been setting up trading stations for hundreds of years around the coast of Africa and on the Black Sea. And they were later going to do the same thing in the Indian Ocean. And the intent by Columbus was also to set up coastal trading forts. That was basically it. He expected to do the same thing that they did on the west coast of Africa, which is basically trade with the natives, or in India, which is trade with the natives and cause minimal disruption. The only difference in the New World is because the New World only had 10% of the global population. They were much less immune to disease, so a lot of people ended up dying off. But that can hardly be blamed on Columbus. I mean, it's the 1490s. People aren't going to be able to figure this out. So yeah, the intent was coastal trading forts. And then when Cortes took over Mexico, that was actually just a fluke. And even then, the Europeans set up colonies where individual native communities could keep their land in perpetuity. And these lasted right into the 1820s. So the idea that they were trying to get rid of them or take them over, let alone commit genocide, is ridiculous. The Spanish crown wanted the native population to increase, not decrease.
And what about this notion that you hear commonly that the Europeans intentionally inflicted disease and plagues upon the Native Americans?
Yeah, I don't know if you got to that point in my book yet, but I could not believe when I look back and found the research on this, there are published articles out there by historians who talk about biological warfare, and they have documented that there was precisely one instance in American history of, quote, white people trying to spread smallpox blankets to the natives. One instance.
And when was that? Wasn't that like later in the 19th century or something? I mean,
really the documented instance is during the French and Indian War, and they're not even sure that it actually went through. They were talking about it. So we're still not sure it went through. And then there's some speculation that something happened in 1820 or 1830 in Illinois, but that's basically just speculation. And so nobody knows about that either. So yeah, I mean, that's what we're talking about. So meanwhile, in the 19th century, what nobody talks about is that the U.S. government instigated an inoculation program almost as soon as a vaccine against smallpox was created. Even Andrew Jackson, who's seen as this anti-Native American president, passed an act which saw thousands of dollars dedicated to making the Indians immune to their worst scourge, smallpox.
And prior to the 19th century, I mean, how much did people know about germs anyway, or biological warfare? I mean, that wasn't even really a thing until maybe the late 18th century?
Well, this is just it. And the people in the French and Indian War, the two commanders who were discussing the smallpox idea, the one commander said, hey, look, our people are just as likely to get this as the natives. And so it was considered a bad idea just because the white people didn't have any immunity to it really either.
Another point of contention in historical circles is that the founding fathers essentially stole the idea of democracy from Native American tribes. I know you addressed that in the book. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is one that's truly crazy, I think. It was the brainchild of a pair of academics who were writing in the 1970s and 80s, and they've been pushing this narrative for decades until it became eventually kind of accepted by the public at large. But in reality, there is no serious historian who believes that American democracy was primarily founded on Native American government. It would be cool, I think, personally, if that was the case. But the reality is that the British government at the time, although they had a king, was still mostly parliamentary. So every state had assemblies. In England, there were assemblies. In the Netherlands, there were assemblies. And so those are the main models that the early American founding fathers were using. Also, of course, they had all grown up studying Greek and Latin, and most of the sources there are talking about Greek and Roman democracy. And so, of course, if they had any models, it was the modern British system and the ancient Greek and Roman system that was first and foremost in their mind. We know this because John Adams wrote a huge book about the democracies of the world then and now, and he does not happen to mention the Iroquois Confederacy, which is what everyone, the conspiracy theories are talking about. Now, I think the Iroquois did have a really interesting governmental system. It was based on committee. It was to some extent democratic, although it was also partly hierarchical. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's where the founding fathers got it. They certainly didn't steal it from them.
We also often hear that the indigenous cultures and civilizations in the New World prior to the arrival of Europeans were all highly sophisticated culturally and technologically, that in some ways they were superior to the Europeans. What's the truth about that, too? Is that just romanticization of indigenous people?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to belittle indigenous culture in any way. I don't think it's necessary to belittle it at all. And that's the thing. I think if people think you don't praise it to the heavens, then you're automatically saying it's terrible. I mean, Native Americans came over as Stone Age hunters. And yet, despite being a relatively small population, the Incas and the Aztecs ended up creating a civilization it was kind of equal to ancient Sumeria, so about 3000 BC. That's pretty impressive. There were other civilizations, you know, in the Southwest US and the Mississippian culture that were sort of like we had around 7000 BC in Mesopotamia, so in Turkey. So they made big strides. At the same time, that does not mean that they were equal to contemporary Europe, and it doesn't make sense that they would be. Again, they only had about one-tenth the population base, so it makes sense if they proceed more slowly along the path of civilization than the people in the old world did. So they were, yes, the most advanced civilizations in the New World were equivalent to about 3000 BC, so the ancient Babylonians, that kind of thing. Which is very impressive, but we don't need to, you know, make more of it than it was.
I think another thing many people think about in terms of this purported exploitation and genocide of Native Americans are the conquistadors. You know, they envision a lot of Spanish conquistadors wiping out all the Aztecs and Incans and stealing all their gold. You have a chapter called "Were the Conquistadors Bloodthirsty Zealots?" And again, I don't want to have to force you to give away spoilers, but were they?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's such an interesting story because in the Spanish-speaking world, people have a more balanced picture of this. But in the Anglophone world, everybody just imagines these bloodthirsty Spaniards hacking their way through hundreds of thousands of natives. It's ridiculous. The reality was much more nuanced and realistic. I mean, Cortez went in with a couple hundred men. And he was just very good at making native allies. Most natives in Mexico were dividing themselves up by tribe, and that's what they did in North America as well. People didn't think of themselves as Native American, of course. They thought of themselves as belonging to their tribe. So these tribes have been warring since time immemorial, and many of them were very happy to ally with Cortez if he was going to take down their hated enemies, the Aztecs. So maybe 100,000 people were killed in the great conquest of Mexico, but Cortez's indigenous allies outnumbered him 20 to 1. So, I mean, who's responsible for those deaths? Most of them were probably killed by native allies of Cortez. So the idea that there was a genocide is very silly. Also, the Spanish outlawed the Aztec practice of human sacrifice. And we think that within 10 years, they probably saved about 300,000 enslaved indigenous people from, you know, being sacrificed alive by the Aztecs. I mean, that in and of itself is a plus, you know, in the body count category.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize to what extent human sacrifice was such a common practice in the New World prior to the arrival of the Europeans and on a mass scale.
Yeah, especially in Mexico. I mean, the Incas did it a while, but the Aztecs had been taking it to a kind of crazy, unsustainable level. And some people think it's because they didn't have many large animals for protein, and so they were, you know, using human sacrifice as cannibal protein, basically. But yeah, the skull wall at Mexico City had room for 100,000 skulls, and they all disintegrated after 2 or 3 years. So that means there was a lot of people being sacrificed.
Wow. Let's talk about another flashpoint for people, a flashpoint of controversy, and that's Thanksgiving Day. Should we be re-envisioning Thanksgiving as a national day of mourning, as many activists would like for us to do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, originally it was a way to give children a sense that the country that they were in was, generally speaking, a good place despite its flaws. Everybody knew that the land had been taken from the natives. Everybody's known that it was kind of a sad thing. You know, it was a wistful thing. It's not something that anybody really wishes had happened. But at the same time, they realized that the first Thanksgiving was a celebration of peace and togetherness. Even though these two cultural groups were quite different, they were able to come together, and they actually forged an alliance which, for the most part, held for half a century after the first Thanksgiving. So, I mean, just that in and of itself, the fact that you can create peace between these two peoples, that the tribes who allied with the English were actually often trying to protect themselves against their own indigenous aggressors. All of these things factor in and show that the original Thanksgiving gives us a lot more to, you know, to cling to that's actually positive than most people think. But we never see that. When you look online, you Google Thanksgiving and you only see day of mourning, genocide, you know, mass murder, slavery. But the colonists were not regularly enslaving Native Americans. There was an understanding against that from the time of Queen Isabella of Spain. And in fact, natives were enslaving each other much more. Certainly women who were captured in war were just incorporated into the tribe, whether they wanted to be or not. And usually children, and the men were usually killed. So I don't know if that's better than slavery, but so this is the kind of society that we saw. So there's a lot more to be thankful for in Thanksgiving than people think. So I don't think we need to see such a negative picture. That's for sure.
Exactly. Let's talk about reparations for Native Americans. You have a chapter about that. And reparations, of course, or at least for the descendants of black slaves in America, are kind of a hot topic today. How should we think about the idea of reparations for Native Americans?
Well, you know, I just wrote something about the reparations issue for another article, and I was doing a bit of research, and I realized that even President Obama swatted away the idea as completely unworkable and impractical in 2008, and then Bernie Sanders tried to do the same thing in 2015. The only difference was by 2015, the rise of BLM had made reparations kind of a flagship issue, and so Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote, I think in The Atlantic, calling Bernie Sanders a white supremacist for not backing the idea of reparations. So it's obviously been inflated as a political football. I think reparations is completely illogical as an historian when you look at, I mean, who would get reparations? There's a huge spectrum of Native Americans. A few are pure blood, but many of them are only half Native, even though they're registered in a tribe. I mean, should you get reparations if half of your relatives were responsible for being mean to the other half of your relatives? I mean, how, your ancestors, how do you play with that? It's so silly. And then there's the other thing, that a lot of tribes were paid a decent amount by 19th century money, but now we sniff at it and say, oh, it was only $20. Well, back then that might have been a huge deal and kept the tribe alive for an entire year. So, you know, once you look at the nitty-gritty of reparations, you see that Native Americans are the most compensated group by the federal government of any. They still own something like 2.5% of all U.S. real estate valued at $700 billion, which they got at the end of the 19th century in perpetuity. Most individual treaties have been adjudicated in the courts. So I think that the reparations issue is just smoke and mirrors to try to get as many concessions from the modern taxpayer as a few activists can try to grab.
You know, about Native Americans and the environment, I think they're often viewed as kind of noble environmentalists who had a close connection, even a spiritual connection to the land, and that Europeans have destroyed all that. You do have a chapter called "Were Native Americans Natural Environmentalists?" What's the truth about the way that Native American tribes interacted with their environment?
Yeah, well, when you look far back in history, you see that, you know, you can't really blame, you know, paleo hunters of 10,000 years ago. But when they first erupted into North America, the large animals on this continent were not used to human hunters. So within a couple thousand years, Native Americans' ancestors had killed off almost all the megafauna. I think it's like 60 species of all sorts of creatures, from bison to deer to big cats to turtles to sloths. So these creatures were all killed off, and then it meant that the North American flora and fauna were, there was a lot less megafauna than there were before. So already right there, the idea that they had some special relationship with nature is, you know, you throw a little bit of cold water on that. And then when you look at the fur trading in the 18th and 19th century, Native Americans were very often just as ready to shoot as much game as their rifles would allow. So if they lived in harmony with nature over the long term, it was mostly because their weapons were such that the animals and the hunters had reached a sort of equilibrium. But once rifles were added to the mix, then Native Americans absolutely were overhunting. And when we look at modern day tribes, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, there's this famous book called The Ecological Indian that's written by an anthropologist at Brown University 20 years ago. And the idea there is to show that many tribes were often sitting opposite, on the opposite side of the table from environmental groups, because they were overhunting, overfishing, or using resources that the environmental groups didn't want them to use. So while some tribes may have been a little more ecological, other tribes were less ecological. Just like any other groups of humans, there's some people who are, quote, you know, good, and some who are bad, according to how you want to categorize them. So the picture is, it's complicated, but to claim some special status, I think, is mostly just done today for political maneuvering rather than to have any basis in reality.
You've got about 20 different topics here that you address, 20 different, shall we say, myths or misconceptions or even lies about European colonialism. What was your favorite? I suppose this is kind of an odd question, but what was your favorite topic to address in this book?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that really surprised me was actually the reaction I got on Twitter from a lot of people who were academics, people who had PhDs, people who ought to know better. And a lot of them were suggesting that every time a native person got near a settler, there was going to be bloodshed. That's what they were suggesting to me. So they said, even in the, you know, in the original Jamestown settlement with Pocahontas and the Powhatan Indians, that people were constantly at loggerheads. Well, you go back and look in the sources and you find that English people were staying with the Indians in their villages as guests for months at a time. And you find that the Powhatan Indians were hanging out around the outskirts of Jamestown, also camping for months at a time. So most of the time, these people were interacting with each other on a day-to-day basis. Everybody wanted to get along. They were trading with each other. They were curious about each other. And so the massive extent to which Native Americans and the early English colonists really trusted each other most of the time was very surprising. Another major thing that surprised me was the extent of the land market east of the Appalachians in the 1600s and the 1700s. So Native groups were continually selling scrap land that maybe they didn't need anymore because their tribe was diminishing in numbers, land that had belonged to another tribe whom they had conquered. There were so many tracts of land which natives were selling, and there's a good economic reason for this. Natives could not make their own firearms or powder, and yet they were pretty much addicted to firearms. It was a pretty useful thing for them to have. They also really liked having metal axes. I mean, try going out in the woods without a metal axe, an iron axe, you know, if you have the option. And knives and cooking utensils and also shirts. So there was a lot of scrubland. And as the tribes diminished through a combination of assimilation and disease, and a lot of it was just assimilation. A lot of natives just wanted to live with the white people. So they did. And we never hear about them again. And people now call that a massacre. But honestly, it was just these people voluntarily saying, hey, this is a great life. I'll go move there. So tribes were pairing off these bits of land. And very often there were half-blood agents who could go between the natives and the whites. And they would act as intermediaries. And these people were often buying and selling real estate from the natives and to the natives. So this land market was another major aspect of colonial history, and even up to the early 19th century, that I had, you know, really no idea just how flourishing that was, and how there were people of all stripes, any race you can think of, who were participating in this market fully and voluntarily.
You reserve a few pages at the end of the book to make the case for objectivity in history. I think it's tragic that a historian even has to make such a plea, but can you explain how we got to this point where many historians have just abandoned objectivity as an ideal or as a standard in pursuit instead of an ideological agenda?
Yeah, it's so sad. Well, I mean, there the president of the American Historical Association, James Sweet, was trying a year or two ago to scold the American Historical Association, so in other words, the whole body of professors, history professors, he was scolding them, saying that they've become too, quote, presentist. In other words, they're only looking at the past in terms of present day issues, basically, you know, race issues and that kind of thing. And he said, we're losing our objectivity. Now, he tried to lay out his credentials as a good liberal before he did all this stuff. But the minute he said, you guys are being too presentist, all hell broke loose. And he basically had to make a groveling apology the next day. So, you know, like the 1619 Project, I find people, you know, in my acquaintance who identify with the Democratic Party say, oh, it's a bunch of, you know, Princeton, Harvard academics who came up with the 1619 Project. It was not. It was a bunch of journalists at the New York Times who don't know any history at all. So these people wrote at the very beginning of the 1619 Project, we want to make race and slavery the crooks around which the story of American history revolves. And obviously they want to do that for political ends. There's no one thing that history revolves around, certainly not something like race or class or gender or whatever it is that somebody can become obsessed with. So history is a complex thing. It has multiple causes and multiple effects. And so anytime that historians jump on the bandwagon, and they did after the 1619 Project, everybody wanted to line up to say, oh, yes, this is great history. This is perfect. This is what we believe. Anytime you get people jumping on a bandwagon that fetishizes one aspect of history, you know it cannot be objective. By definition, this is a subjective definition of history. Now, unfortunately, in the United States, because, you know, most historians, everybody wants to be seen as a good person. You don't want to be quoted saying Black lives don't matter, because that's what everybody assumes as soon as you argue against the 1619 Project. Then, you know, partially everyone just wants to seem like a nice person. Nobody wants to rock the boat. But what that means is people don't stand up for the truth. And at first it's little things, but after a while it becomes really large, egregious issues that people end up saying. So I'm not allowed to say when I do the history of slavery that, you know, African chiefs first kidnapped and sold the Africans who ended up being sold to Europeans. If I mention that fact at all, you know, you get booed out of the room. So, but that's just an essential part. You cannot understand the Atlantic slave system unless you realize there was a lot of African agents who were going through, and because they were politically disorganized, they were capturing each other and selling each other. They were doing this before the Europeans arrived. So if I'm not allowed to say a fundamental part of my historical story that I'm looking at, if I have to pretend that the settlers were always massacring Indians when I know from the sources that they were not, then I think somebody has to stand up for objectivity and truth. But sadly, most of my colleagues are basically too cowardly to do it. And I'm happy to say that, you know, live online.
Are you optimistic that academia can reclaim objectivity as a standard, or are academics just too hopelessly mired in this kind of social justice perspective and activism? What's it going to take to turn that around?
I think that eventually the truth will out. I'm a firm believer in democracy. I'm a believer that the people will eventually gravitate toward the truth. You know, Abraham Lincoln was right. You can't fool all the people all the time. And I think it's going to be the same way with historians. We know we're supposed to speak the truth. We call ourselves scientists. We claim that we're looking at a scientific vision of the facts. And because, quote, wokeness became such a fad, really beginning around 2015, 2016, that makes me think that hopefully in another 10 years, it'll go out of fashion again, or 5 years, and then we won't have to worry about this so much. I was looking at a couple of reviews, book reviews from the year 2010, and there were academics saying, do we really need to write about or talk about race anymore? Haven't we moved past race? Haven't we, with the Civil Rights Act, basically eliminated most of the problems? Certainly with the election of a black president in the United States. And then by 2013, with BLM, suddenly everybody was acting like the U.S. was the most racist country on earth, when 3 years earlier, people were acting like we were a post-racial society. So if things could change that much, you know, for the worse, I think, then they should be able to change to the better. People become more sane again relatively quickly.
I hope so. You conclude the book by pointing out that many historians and stolen land activists believe that they are championing justice for the historically downtrodden people. But what are they actually doing, and what are they enabling by obscuring the truth about European colonialism?
Yeah, precisely. That's a very good question. That's one of my main concerns in the book. I think that any time that you intentionally obscure the truth, like I think I have a lot of colleagues who think you're right. They're doing the moral thing. They're talking about how people were downtrodden in the past. But they, in order to do that, they're assuming that society is based on, let's say, the oppression of one race by another, that racial oppression is the crux around which history revolves, as we just said. And I think that if you obscure history to fit the facts of your theory, then because your theory is only ever partially true, that you're actually making policy decisions, intelligent policy decisions, less likely to succeed. So in other words, when your theory is only partially true, but you act as if it's the total truth, then if you make policies trying to fight racism, you're going to miss the other five reasons why, say, black people are poorer than white people on average in the United States. So your policy is going to be ineffectual, and I think you end up harming the people you're trying to help because you've used a distorted version of history and a kind of wonky theory. It was basically only Marxists who tried to fit the facts of history to phase Marx to fit the Marxist theory. And I'm afraid that the new radical left is kind of doing the same thing. They're the heirs of the old Marxist way of doing things. I thought we had seen the end of that, but I guess not.
Your final chapter, or actually your conclusion, is titled Toward a Balanced History of European Colonialization. Outside of academia, what can we do in the culture to sort of wake people up to this kind of balanced history? I mean, apart from people buying your book, which, you know, can lead the way, what can people, or how in the culture can we turn that narrative around and arrive at a more balanced understanding of history or European colonialism specifically?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple other books like mine that are beginning to be written where people are fighting back a little bit against this. And so, yeah, there needs to be crucial members of the public who arm themselves with those narratives. But absolutely, we're going to need to see a concerted effort by politicians and just grassroots people who are working with local school boards to make sure that history is taught in an objective way. I think one of the other really important things is that we realize that civics classes are really important. We need to know how our democracy functions. And for that, we need some stories. We need to tell children some of the good sides of what's happened. We can't be uniformly negative, no matter how much the left might want to portray it that way. So if parents speak out, if school officials start to change the curriculum, then eventually we might see a grassroots public movement towards balance. I don't think we need to be, I mean, nobody needs to be anti-Native American. That's ridiculous. I mean, we want to celebrate the achievements of Native Americans as much as possible. But at the same time, we don't need to be anti-European in order to be pro-Native American. It's just so ridiculous. History is not a zero-sum game. You can say, yeah, the Native Americans were cool, but Europeans did some cool stuff too. And so something as simple as not seeing history as a zero-sum game, teaching our students that, but also teaching our teachers to teach that way, would be a really good first step, I think.
Well said. Professor, where's the best place for people to go to keep up with your writing and what you're doing now?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I keep track of, well, I keep a record of what I'm doing on Twitter mostly, and that's where people can find what my latest articles are that I'm writing. And I have started a little YouTube channel as well, which I plan to do more uploading for. Those are probably the best things. Also, Amazon Author Central, I'm working on that and trying to keep it pretty live.
Dr. Jeff Finn Paul, thanks so much for coming on today at the Right Take Podcast, and thanks especially for your important book. People, that title again is Not Stolen, The Truth About European Colonialism in the New World. It is a must read. Get your own copy before Amazon.com decides that it's too politically incorrect to sell. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Just another reminder to subscribe to the Right Take Podcast so you don't miss any of the conversations we're having here. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It really helps. Thanks, and be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.